This is the Plain Dealing Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. I'm Adam Miller. I'm the preacher for the Plain Dealing Church of Christ. This sermon was delivered back in August the 13th of 2023. It was a final sermon in a series from the book of James, and it deals with the final thoughts from James as he wraps up his epistle to Christians to live practically and faithfully for Christ. Hope it's a blessing for you. I hope you enjoy the sermon. Weeks now, and today we will end the study here in chapter 5. And so as we started this study about James, we said that James is sort of like a handbook for practical Christianity. Now I want to say this again, I want to reiterate this over and over. I'm not saying that James has everything you need to know about being a Christian. In fact, you're not going to find a lot of marriage text in the book of James or how to raise your children, although there are principles there that may apply to those things. Specifically, if we're thinking about not being judgmental and showing grace, that applies very well in our marriages and in our homes. And so there are things to glean. But James takes our concept of what do we believe, and it says, well, this is what it looks like when you act that out. I think one of the great tragedies we have in our world is that a lot of people say, well, I believe in Jesus. I am a Christian. I would call myself a follower of Jesus, but it doesn't demonstrate in any way in their life that can be measured. It doesn't come across in any tangible way. They live like they did before they said they believed in Jesus. They have maybe the same sort of relationships they had. They treat people the same way they did. They have not changed any behaviors. And James instructs us that if we're going to say we have faith, that it ought to be accompanied by works that are demonstrable of a person who has a living, true faith. And so this is our final study, and today we're going to look at three. There's really three big sections here that we're going to break out in James chapter 5. And warning ahead, the first section here, the first section here is going to step on my toes, and I'll go ahead and confess that here right off the bat. So we'll begin in verse 1 where James says, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasure in the last days. Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your field, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you." Now, James here at the end, instead of toning things down, really unloads both barrels on a certain group of follower of Jesus. And he says, "Come now, you rich." You rich. About once every year or two, I'll go and do this. And I should have looked up the actual website. But there is a calculator. You can go online. Just search for World Wealth Calculator. And it should pull it up. But you can type in your hourly income or your annual income, your monthly income. And just type that in there. And it will tell you where you rank in the world as far as how wealthy you are. It's not uncommon for us today when we're talking to people to talk about, oh, how broke we are, oh, times are tough, or things are getting tight, or I need a bigger pay raise, we need this. We hear that language all of the time. In fact, in America, the majority of our political talk today seems to revolve around more funding for this or more funding for that or more pay for this or higher pay for that. People are striking here or there for more wages, this, that, and the other. We hear this all the time, and we talk all the time about being broke. But it is a wake-up call to go to the World Wealth Calculator, type in your income, and see that the chances are the majority of the people in this room probably rank somewhere around 98th percentile. In fact, if you make about $30,000 a year as a household, you're probably going to be above 96 or 97% of the rest of the world as far as measurable wealth. In other words, God has given you resources to do with more than the overwhelming majority of the other 8 billion or so people on the earth. We are the rich. Here in this congregation, here in this town, here in this country, we are the rich. Now that does not imply or mean or mandate that this warning applies to us. Because wealth in itself is not a sinful thing. One of the most misquoted verses in all the Bible is when Paul says to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6 that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. You've probably heard many times someone say, well, the Bible says that the love of money is the root of all evil. Or that money is the root of all evil. You've probably heard that before too. Well, the Bible does not say that money is the root of all evil. It says the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And so what Paul was warning Timothy about was, is there is a tremendous danger, he says there right after that, those who desire to be rich fall into a snare. And so here James is warning us in a parallel to Jesus' warning about laying up treasures on earth. And remember, much of James is a parallel to the teachings of Christ and specifically to the teachings in the Sermon on the Mount. And so you, as you read this section, you may have, if you're familiar with Matthew 5, 6, and 7, the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 6 should have been just jumping out in your ear when James says this, "Weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire." You may remember Jesus said, "Do not lay up treasures on earth." And he gave a warning that three things would happen to those treasures. He said that moths will eat them. In other words, they'll be destroyed. Or they'll be corroded by rust. They will simply just wear out. Or number three, thieves will break in and steal. And so James uses that understanding we would have had from the teaching of Jesus about earthly treasures, earthly things, being sort of a foolhardy investment. You know, sometimes in our world today, people ask, and I hear people say, you know, I don't know if I should be putting my retirement in the stock market. I feel like it's going to crash. Or, you know, some people right now are big about putting their money, put it into gold, buy gold, buy gold, buy gold. And other people are putting their money into Bitcoin and digital currency, all the cryptocurrency, all these other things. Where's the best investment? Should I put it in real estate? Should I put it in bonds? Should I put it here? Jesus would say, it doesn't matter. Because everywhere, if you're heart is laid up, if your heart is rather geared towards and focused on laying up treasures here on earth, you're going to lose them one way or the other. You know, Solomon talked about in the book of Ecclesiastes that a rich man leaves an inheritance to his children that they go out and squander. So many times, and mom's not here this morning, she's home sick, and so I'll tell on her a little bit. All the time she'll be driving her old, you know, 100-year-old car or worn-out clothes or worn-out shoes. I said, "Mom, go get you a new pair of shoes or go get you a new car." And, "Well, we want to leave you some money." And I said, "Mom, I would rather you have a decent pair of shoes." And I said, "I hope you leave everything to Haley because she's got to sort all that stuff out, right?" And you know, sometimes we think about things like, "Well, I want to leave money to my, I want my kids to be rich. I want this, I want that." There's no guarantee they will. And that's what Solomon warned about. Solomon said, you may leave everything to your children and they go out and squander it all and not value what you gave them. The point is, there's no way to secure earthly riches. There's no way to be sure that if we put money into the stock market or a mutual fund or a 401k or if we buy gold or if we go out and invest in real estate, there's no guarantee that any of those investments will be secure. And in fact, when we put our trust in those things, the danger is we have trusted in worldly riches and we've not trusted in God to provide. And so James says rich people, people who put their heart into trusting in riches, they need to weep and howl. You shouldn't be happy about that. You should be a mourner. Because the sad fact is there are going to be a lot of people on the day of judgment who had everything and all the comforts they wanted in this world and they made no preparation for the next world and they will be the ones to suffer. Remember the story in Luke chapter 16 of the rich man and Lazarus? The Bible says, Jesus says in Luke 16, there was a rich man who fared sumptuously every day. And there was a poor man, a beggar, who laid at his gate full of sores. His name was Lazarus. And he said he would have desired to eat the crumbs that fell from the rich man's table. Both men died, Jesus said. And it says that Lazarus went and he was taken to Abraham's bosom and was comforted. And the rich man, he was taken to Hades. He was there in torment, and he was crying out for just a little drink of cool water. And he cries out for Abraham. And he said, what is he told there? He's told, you had everything in this life. And now you've lost it all in this one. Christian, we need to wake up. I know that we have to make retirement plans. I'm not saying don't take out. I have retirement accounts. I'm trying to invest because I'm trying to be frugal and I'm trying to be thoughtful about how we're going to be taken care of when we're no longer able to work. And, you know, you need to be thinking about insurance if you're not able to physically work. You know, all those things are things you need to think about. And I'm not telling you not to prepare. But what James is saying and what the lesson is this morning is, do not put your faith in that money. Because it can all be taken from you. Moths can eat everything. It can be destroyed. It can be, you know, you may build some big fancy, oh, I got my house paid for, and a fire burns it to the ground. James says here that if that is your attitude, you need to prepare to suffer. In fact, he says, your gold and your silver have corroded. Their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You've laid up treasure in the last days. Now, this is ironic here because Jesus said, but lay up treasure in heaven where neither moth nor rust corrupt nor thieves break in and steal. And he says, when we lay up earthly treasure, we are laying up a treasure in heaven of sorts. But it's not the kind we want. He says the treasure we're laying up in the last day is the treasure of God's vengeance. Notice what he says, and notice the marks here of this kind of rich man. He says, number one, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you. When we love money, we are going to be more apt to be stingy. I want to encourage you. Here's a practical application of this today. I know most of us here in a small town, there's not a lot of restaurants that we go and we probably eat with mama or grandma today. But if you go out today, especially on Sunday, and you look like you just came from a church building, and you go and eat at some restaurant, and you tip that poor waitress a dollar, shame on you, Christian. Because number one, you've just made the bride of Christ look stingy and not generous and not someone who's grateful for the service. But you've also defrauded someone who's serving you and working for you. Christians should be generous. And if you can't afford the tip, don't go to the restaurant. The answer is people should be paid. You know, sometimes today I'll take my truck to a mechanic and never get it back. That's a story. If you want to hear it, I'll tell you later. If your mechanic wrecks your truck twice, you've had problems. But anyway, and they'll say, well, it's this much. And they'll say, I'm sorry, it's so high. And I say, I'm not. And it always surprised them. I said, what do you mean? I said, I've worked my whole life. I've built houses, remodeled houses. I've gotten out and sweated. I said, I do not mind. And this is true. I do not mind paying someone for their work. Because I've had people try to cut me back on my work. Well, can I get that brother-in-law? Can I get that Christian price? I've worked for people in the church, not here. But I've worked for people in the church before. Well, you're the preacher. You ought to charge less. Okay, well, I'll try to be generous to you, but can you return that to me? You see, what James says is all this betrays greed. When we try to defraud someone of the money, it betrays that we love our money more than we love our person that's working for us or helping us in some way. And so here James says we shouldn't be people who are in love with the money we have because it is a sinful position to be in. He says here, you have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You've condemned and murdered the righteous person. James says, you fatten yourself up, but just like a pig for the slaughter, like a calf for the slaughter. And God is going to judge you for that. Jesus tells us where to find our hearts in Matthew 6 and verse 21 when he says, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. You know, God's given us so much, and we need to be careful that we're generous with what God has given us. We need to make sure that we pay others what they are worth. We need to make sure that no one ever leaves a transaction with a Christian and thinks, well, they stiffed me or they did me wrong. We need to always make sure that we're overly generous. And because we're more concerned about the person in the transaction than we are about the dollars in the transaction. If not, the danger is real. Now the second section here in James chapter 5 is going to be down in verses 7 and following. And again, James is pulling on metaphors that are wonderful for us here. He talked about there fattening ourselves for slaughter. And here he's going to be talking about some metaphors that many of us are familiar with. These are farming metaphors. He says, "Be patient therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brother, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You've heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation." Now here James teaches us a lesson, and here is the text. Be patient. Establish your hearts. Now this is something you will not hear at a church that preaches the so-called prosperity gospel, which is no gospel at all. Being a Christian is not a life where everything works out instantly. Being a follower of Christ is a lifetime of struggle and patience waiting on God's deliverance. And James tells us here that if we are going to be followers of Christ, we need to have the mindset of a farmer. He says, you know, a farmer doesn't just go out on one day and till up his ground and plant his seeds, put a little water on it, come back the next morning and say, "Boy, I'm ready for some corn." You understand there's going to be, 7 to 10 days for that stuff to break up through the ground. Then you're going to have to water it and fertilize it. You're going to have to get out there and hoe it. You're going to have to get the weeds out of it, till the ground, work that garden, go again, brave the heat, go. And by the time you realize it would have been cheaper to have bought it at the store. And then, after a couple of months of hard work and sweat, and you're sick of your garden, then you can eat the corn. Then you can pick the peas. Then you can enjoy the tomatoes. Then you can pull the squash, right? Gardening is a lesson in patience. And James says in the same way, being a part of the kingdom of God is like being in a garden. We've got to learn that the fruit of the Spirit does not come overnight. In Galatians chapter 5, we read that the fruit of the Spirit is contrasted there to the works of the flesh. He says the works of the flesh are evident. And he lists off all those things that, by the way, anyone can do. We're living in a world today where people wear the badge of pride and they're so arrogant about their sin. And what Paul explains there in Galatians 5 is those works of the flesh, anyone can lose their temper and say bad words. Anyone can go out and commit sexual immorality. Anyone can do that because you're just being led by the flesh. It takes no patience. It takes no talent. It takes no effort to commit sin. But the fruit of the Spirit. And he uses that metaphor on purpose because, you see, fruit does not come overnight. And this is something we need to remember. Is what? Love, joy, peace, patience, gentleness, kindness, goodness, self-control. Those things do not happen overnight. No more than we say, "Well, I've been baptized, I'll be more patient tomorrow." No. "Well, I've been baptized, I'll be more self-controlled tomorrow." No, James says you have to have the patience of a farmer who understands that the harvest is many months away from the day I till the ground. And that means in your spiritual life, you are not going to see the things crop up overnight. I see so many people, and we've seen over the years, in all these years I've worked with the church and tried to help serve in ministry, I don't know how many people I've seen, they go through some traumatic event in their life, they show up at church, we're grateful to see them, and they're right where they need to be, and they're there 2, 3, 4 weeks, and nothing's changed. And then they're gone again. And I don't know, I've never had anyone tell me this, but I suspect that a lot of people think, "Well, I need to be in church. Maybe church will fix what's wrong." And they show up and they hear a few sermons and feel good, and then nothing's really changed. They're still having the fight with their wife when they go home. They're still having the trouble with their kids. They're still battling the addiction. And they said, "Nothing's changed. What's wrong?" And maybe we've done a pretty bad job of saying this. Christianity and being a Christ follower and the change and the fruit that we want to see, it doesn't happen in a moment of conversion. It happens over a lifetime of maturation. Be patient. be patient. It takes time. Now, notice what James says here about being patient. Not only does a farmer wait, but notice what he says. He says, establish your hearts. What does that mean? That means set your expectation. You know, the Proverbs writer says, hope deferred makes the heart sick. What does that mean? What does that mean, hope deferred makes the heart sick? You remember when you were a kid and you had a birthday or Christmas or something was coming up and you had that thing you wanted? I always wanted a four-wheeler. I never understood why mom and dad didn't go buy one of those expensive machines that would have probably wrapped me around a tree and killed me. Now I do that I'm an adult. I always thought, man, this Christmas I'll get me a... Yeah, I'll be out there tootling around with Jeffrey and the rest of them. We'll be causing all kind of trouble. Probably wise. Do you ever want something, though, and then you thought you... I never thought I was going to get that, by the way. But there were times I'd circled it in the Sears Wish Book, kids. If you need to know about that, we'll tell you later. It's a 4 Amazon list. I'd put out the hints. Hey, I'd really like this. And then you open the package and it's... You ever have that happen as a kid? You ever apply for a job and you're the most qualified person for the job and be a really nice advancement for your family, there's more income, more all that stuff, easier job, and you're the... and through nepotism or something, maybe the boss's cousin gets the job or something, you didn't even see it coming. Hope deferred makes the heart sick. That means that when our expectations are not met, that we deal with real disappointment and sadness. And disappointment will destroy our faith because it leads to discouragement. And so here's what James warns us here in our patience. He says, in your patience as a Christian, he says, be patient, establish your hearts. And what that means is you need to set your expectations as a Christian that my life is not necessarily going to be easy or perfect now. That being a Christian is not about fixing all my problems overnight. This is a long-term process, but God is still faithful. And when I still have fights with my spouse, and when I still have problems with my children, and when I still wrestle with temptation and I fail and I commit sin, and when I still beat my head against the wall over the same thing, that I know those are part of the process, but it doesn't mean God doesn't care or God's not there. Be patient and establish your heart. Had someone ask me this Friday night, just this Friday night, he said, how do you not get mad? How do you not get mad when, you know, you get excited about something in the church and no one else gets excited or there's some big push to do something and no one will get involved? He said, how do you not? He said, I just get angry. And I said, one of two things is true. I said, either I become cynical. I said, or the Lord's given me the wisdom to see that. And one of my best friends in the world, his father just died this week, Jason Kelly. He used to have a saying, he's an old country carpenter, he was one of our deacons. And he said, Adam, you need to remember, people's people. And Dad used to always think that was a funny saying, but you know, there's a lot of wisdom in that. People's people. And what it means is this. I now understand that everyone in the church that I'm a part of, just like me, is struggling through their faith just like me. And so when I get excited about something and want to do something and they don't get as excited, or you can't make this work, or you can't invite this person to church, or this person won't want to have a Bible study with you, or you can't seem to help see the church, I don't get angry anymore. I just realize that this is something that takes time and patience. And I anticipate that there will be disappointments. I anticipate that there will be moral failures. I anticipate that there will be people who will aggravate me and I will aggravate them, vice versa. In fact, notice what the next verse says. He says in verse 9 of James 5, do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. One of the great tendencies and one of the great temptations of Christians, when you put people together working together, you have something like VBS and you know, you have different personalities, you know, pick your personality test. Maybe somebody's a 1 on the Enneagram and this person's an 8 and this person's a 4 and this person's a 6, if you know what the Enneagram is. Or if you like my favorite old personality test, you know, the otter and the lion and the Labrador retriever, you know, and the beaver, and you got some beavers over here and a lion over here and an otter over here. Here's our otter. Ah! You know, that's me. And the Labrador Retriever's like, oh, they're wearing me out. If you don't know anything about personality tests, I'll talk to you about that later. My point is there are different kinds of people in the church. And when we put them all together and make them work together for a common goal, sometimes we rub one another the wrong way. And James says, don't you dare grumble at one another. Don't gang up in a group and start talking bad about this person over here and gang up on them and talk about how terrible they are. Don't you criticize this person over here. He says, why? You're judging them and the judge is actually standing at the door. Jesus is going to judge them. You don't need to. This is patience. Do you know how much patience it takes to work with someone who gets on your nerves and not openly criticize them to others? It takes a lot of patience. And so the other practical part of Christianity is when we get together in a group of Christians, we've got to be very patient with one another, and we've got to learn to tolerate one another. Over in the very next book in our Bible, in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8, Peter says, and above all things. In other words, he's just given him a whole list of laundry list of instructions, and he says, above all that, more importantly than all that, have fervent love one for another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. Here's something I know about me. I can aggravate the stew out of people. I know that I've got that otter person. There are times I get, I'm excited. When I get down to church camp and I've got to be in charge, sometimes I can be mean. Asked a young lady the other night, I said, do you think I'm mean? She said, why do you keep asking that? I said, because I probably keep being mean to you. Because every time I'm around you at camp, we're getting on to, you know, I know that's not fun. There are times we work together, we may aggravate one another. We try to serve together, we work together. We have different ideas about VBS and how we should decorate, what theme, do this, do that. What speaker should we have? What song should we sing? What songbook should we have? What should the temperature be on the thermostats? All that stuff. We can really get frustrated with one another. And James says, be patient. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You've heard of the steadfastness of Job. And you've seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. In other words, when you are suffering, when you are struggling, one of the key things you need to do as a Christian is stay the course. Just don't quit. You say, this Christian life is so hard. Well, you're probably doing it right. Remember, it's easy to sin. It's easy to love money. It's easy to love pleasure. It's easy to love laziness and leisure. It's easy to love the world. It's a struggle to serve God. Now, the final text or the final section we want to look at is here in beginning in verse 13, where we read that James says, if anyone among you is suffering, let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing praise or psalms. James says, and this is very important, church, we should know how others feel. I think there's a great danger when we come together once a week and we all wear our mask. You ask everybody this morning, how are you today? Oh, I'm doing great, doing fine, everything's good. No complaints, can't complain. How many times do we hear things like that? You ever had the brother or sister come in and say, oh, my knee's hurting today, and I'm behind on my bills, and my air conditioner, and you're like, oh, no, right? I want to hear the can't complain, just give me that. James here is telling us that as a church, we should be able to be open with one another about what's wrong and what's right. Notice he says, if anyone is happy, what? Let him sing songs. I like that verse because sometimes I'll just randomly be walking around singing and people look at you kind of funny when you do that. When I'm out cutting hay or cutting grass, I'm out there belting it out. And I'm sure people drive by, what is wrong with that cat, right? I like to sing. I'm happy a lot. But a lot of times when I'm sad, I don't tell you. I want to cover that up. I don't want to let you know. But James says, if anyone is suffering, let him pray. Now, we're talking about here not just privately in your closet. We're talking about as a church. In fact, notice what he goes on to say. He says, Is anyone among you sick? Let him call for the elders of the church. I want to point out here this morning, and this is not a shot at anyone, and I am, if I am asked to pray for you or pray with you, that is one of the greatest privileges in my life, and I'm always honored to do that. But I have been in a hospital room before visiting with elders, and someone would say, Adam, you want to pray for us? And if the elders are there, I always say, you want one of these guys to pray for you? Now, I'm going to point out why that's important here in the next few verses. But James is explicit. When we get sick, he says, you call for the church elders to pray for you. Now, we'll get into this here in just a moment a little bit more. But he says, call for the elders of the church and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of faith will save the one who is sick, and the Lord will raise him up. Now, there's been a lot of talk about this. They said, wait, that sounds an awful lot like healing. Some people have said, well, what we're talking about here is not physical sickness. It's talking about spiritual sickness. And we're talking about here the elders restoring the sick person. Possibly, but I don't think that's the context. Others have said, and I think this is probably more close to right, James was written, remember, when the elders of most churches would have been given the Spirit of God by the laying on of hands of the apostles. The apostles, one of their jobs was to go all over the new church and to lay their hands on church elders and give them the power to do things like speak in tongues and heal the sick, etc., etc. And so likely what James is saying here is that if you have a sick person, don't turn to the physicians. You have the power of God in your church to heal this person. Call them. Turn to God. Now, we don't have that today. I wish we did. I don't know how many times I've visited with someone who's suffering or hurting in pain. I visited with people sometimes that are in such pain that you can tell they don't even really want you in the room. And so I always I'm here, I'm going to pray for you, I'm getting out of there. Because I understand when I'm hurting, I don't mean it personally, I don't really want anyone around. I don't want anyone seeing me like that, do you? And I wish so bad. I wish that I had the power to ask God and He'd just take all that away. I wish we did. We don't have that today. The early church had that miraculously. They could heal cancer. They could heal, you know, someone had an arm chopped. They could fix anything. We don't have that. But I think the principle still applies. That when we're suffering, we call the church elders. Now, why the church elders? Well, look at verse 16. Therefore, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The prayer of a righteous person has great power as it is working. Why the elders? Because our elders in the church are supposed to be the absolute epitome of righteous men. The elders are, by structure, by God's design, the men who meet the spiritual qualifications of eldership should be the model of righteousness in the church. And so if we want a powerful prayer of a righteous person, who would I call? The best of the best, the eldership. I know for a fact there have been times where I've visited with elders and someone's asked me to pray and I've thought to myself, my life's all messed up. I'm spinning out here on the highway, out of control. Yes, I know some Bible verses, but my life is not where it needs to be. And this man right here is a rock. You want him talking to God for you. Now again, I'll be glad to pray for anyone with anyone every day of the week. In fact, tonight at 6:00, we're going to be up here for roughly an hour just to pray. I'm so glad this sermon fell on this night because we've had good participation, but it'd be wonderful if we had complete participation, if we had 40 or 50 people come and just share what's on your heart and share what you need to pray for, because this is what the church is all about. Someone says, I don't need the church. If you don't have the church, you don't have other people who can rejoice with you, and you don't have other people who can pray with you. He goes on to explain that, you know, Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed fervently that it might not rain. And for 3 years and 6 months, it did not rain on the earth. And he prayed again, and heaven gave rain, and the earth bore its fruit. What he says is Elijah was no Superman. He was a regular man, but he was a righteous man. And God listened to his voice. I wonder how many times in the church we want growth, but we haven't prayed for it together. How many times in the church we want revival, but we haven't prayed for it together? How many times in the church we want to love each other more, but we haven't prayed for that together? How many times in the church, like James said in chapter 4, we do not have because we have not asked? The final point as we wrap this sermon up, the last two verses here of James, he sort of just ends this. And I think these are important words for us to hear as we close today and close the book. He says, "My brothers, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone brings him back, let him know that whoever brings back a sinner from his wandering will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins." I don't know why we got to a culture or how we got in a culture where the idea of telling someone what you're doing is not right has become so taboo. I can't think of anything right now in America that is considered more taboo than to come to someone like, there's Reagan, he's just looking at me and he's on the front pew, someone chooses Reagan. If I said, "Reagan, you know, I heard you were involved in this, and man, that's not right. And you need to repent, and you need to get back to God, and you need to come make it right. We love you and we care." If I told him that today, do you know how many people would say, "You're being so judgmental, you're a hypocrite, you have sin too, you shouldn't go talk to him about his sin"? Where did we get that idea? James tells us it's actually our responsibility to look out for our fellow Christians. He says, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone brings him back, let him know that whoever brings back a sinner from his wandering will save his soul from death. We just saw 93 people burn up in Hawaii. And imagine someone knowing there were people in the path of that fire and saying to them, "Well, you know, I don't want to go criticize where they're standing because I don't want them to think, you know, I chose to stand here and they chose to stand there, and I know the fire's coming, but, you know, I know they're in danger, but I don't want to hurt their feelings," right? That would be ludicrous. That's silly, right? If we knew the fire was coming, we'd say, "Hey, get out, there's a fire coming, let's go." James says, when we see someone who's a brother, a fellow Christian, and they get involved in something they shouldn't be involved in, he says, you go and find that person and you say, "Come back home. This isn't right. What you're doing is not right. You have a God who loves you, and you made a covenant with that God, and you made a commitment with that God, and you're breaking your commitment with God." And James says, you're saving his soul from death. Understand, someone says, "Well, once we're saved, we're always saved." This verse proves that's not true. Because notice he says, if anyone among you, this isn't outsiders, we're not talking about lost people, he's talking about in the church, wanders from them. How can you wander from where you've not been? Again, we're not talking about people, we're talking about Christians who are getting into sin, and James says when you bring them back, you save them from death. Now remember, you say, "Well, we're not to judge." He just spent a large part of two chapters talking about not judging. We're not talking about judging. You know, if someone is involved in an adulterous affair, I've not done any judgment if I find out about that and say, "This isn't right." Because Jesus made it pretty clear in this book right here, it's not right to be unfaithful to your spouse. If I find out someone's stealing money from their job, I'm not judging them if I say you ought not to do that, because in this book, we've already read, you shall not steal, right? And Paul says in Ephesians 4, let him who steals steal no longer. I'm not judged their behavior. God has. I'm observing their behavior, and I'm trying to get them out of the destruction that that behavior is going to bring, because sin results in death. James 1 in verse 15. And so as we wrap this letter up, James is really talking to us about the highest form of love. And that's the form of love where I care enough about you to tell you something you don't want to hear and I don't want to tell you. And that's when I tell you, you need to change. This morning, if you're here, I hope that you have benefited from our study in the book of James. And if you're here this morning and you're not a follower of Christ, we'd invite you to become one. It's not an easy path, but it's worth every day and worth every moment that we live for Christ. He transforms us from the inside out, and he allows us to live a life where we are free from the judgment of our sin. And James teaches us how to live that life practically, with patience, with love, without judgmental thoughts in our hearts, with kindness, and with goodness and righteousness.